My name is Ed Marquardt, and I am a pastor at Grace Lutheran Church in Des Moines, Washington, which is a suburb of Seattle. And a few years ago, must have been about four years ago now, I, like so many pastors, it was that time to teach some courses in evangelism in the life of our church. And the kind of materials that were available to me, I wasn't especially pleased with. They just didn't conform to a theological framework, which was Lutheran, or there were some methodological problems in some of the others. And so what I started to do was just read an awful lot on evangelism and fashioned a course for our congregation, which I taught a few times. And then some of my friends said, well, hey, we'd like to use that material. And so they started to use it. And then gradually, a couple of years ago, I went to a conference in Rochester, Minnesota, where they brought together many people in the Lutheran Church who were doing some homegrown work on evangelism. And from that, published a course called Witnesses for Christ. And basically, it's a course which is designed for Lutheran congregations. Here are an example of the student guide and the leader's guide. I think that maybe there's 1,500, maybe 2,000 congregations who have bought the leader's guide. I'm not sure how many are using it yet, but gradually that there's a larger number of churches throughout the country which is starting to use this material. And what I would like to do tonight in the hour that we have together is to give you a brief introduction as to what is trying to be accomplished in this course, a little bit about the nature of unchurched people here in the United States. Okay. And to begin with, I'd like to begin with first by talking about the mission of the church. I'm convinced that the way a pastor defines the mission of the church is the way that pastor will try to lead his or her congregation. Very important statement. Anytime you're going to interview a pastor for a call, if you're a layman on a call committee, you always try to find out their definition of the mission of the church. Because when you understand what a pastor's mission of the church is, you will have a feeling for the direction that pastor will try to take this congregation. Okay? And I've laid out for you here a sixfold mission of the church on the board, both an inner and an outer mission of the church. The inner mission of the church having three cylinders, the outer mission of the church having three cylinders. And so basically you have the metaphor of a six-cylinder car. And in the Lutheran church, it seems like we operate essentially on four of the six cylinders. So I would like to talk about the six missions of the church. The inner mission and the outer mission. And the inner mission of the church to itself, the congregation's mission to itself, it's a mission inward, is characterized by word, sacrament, and Christian community. And I'd like to briefly talk about each of those. Obviously, we are a church we are committed to the word of Christ. And so our sermons, our hymns, our confirmation classes, everything that we do, we try to do in such a way is to have people, to have the word of God, the living words of Christ, the living words of the Bible, live inside of people. We do everything possible to facilitate the learning of the Word, that the Word of Christ, that the presence of Christ dwells in you richly. I give you thousands of examples of that, but tonight, usually the presentation that I'm giving tonight usually takes about 2 hours. I'm going to really condense it, and so I'm going to eliminate lots of those examples tonight. But it's interesting for me, in terms of preaching, under the theme of the intermission of the word, is when a pastor is going to preach a kind of sermon which reaches out to unchurched people, where you have lots of unchurched people coming to the congregation. I've noticed three characteristics of that kind of preaching. One, it's always related to human need, to their needs. Secondly, that it's through the Bible. They sense that the pastor is talking through the Bible. And thirdly, it's in language that they can understand. Those are the kinds of churches that unchurched people are looking for. They're looking for a certain kind of place, and the kind of preaching that they're looking for is preaching which relates to human need through the scriptures in language that they can understand. And so when it's done, they say, I can understand what you're talking about, preacher. I can understand that, and it applied to my life. And that was somehow helpful to me. The second characteristic of the intermission to ourselves in a Lutheran church is that of the sacraments, baptism and Holy Communion. That ours is a sacramental church. The Presbyterians in their studies a number of years ago, the people were asked what was the most important part of the worship service for them. Believe it or not, even Presbyterians had listed Holy Communion. It was a very sacred time. In the life of the Lutheran Church, gradually we're starting to offer communion on an every Sunday basis. Gradually in the Lutheran Church has been a renewed appreciation for Holy Communion. I think of Edie Wills in our congregation when she was dying, and I went to give her Holy Communion, and she had cancer of the throat, and she couldn't swallow and talk and all that kind of stuff. And I gave her Holy Communion, and as I gave it to her, I read those words from John 6, "He who eats my body and drinks my blood will never die." And she grabbed a pen, and she wrote it on the paper, and she said, "What did you say?" And I said, "Well, he who eats my body and drinks my blood will never die." She wrote back, "Where did you find that?" And I said, "John 6, and she pulled out her Bible, and she marked it down. We are people who live on the sacrament, who eats my body and drinks my blood will never die. Third mark of the intermission to ourselves as a Christian congregation is that of Christian love or Christian community. In fact, the number one reason why unchurched people join a congregation today is not because of hot dog preaching, nor because of souped up youth programs, but primarily because there will be a community of people in which they are known and loved, and they can know and that's a change over the last 20 years. It's really kind of interesting. In many ways, that the church is becoming like what I used to think about ninth grade confirmants. My point was, if you had a confirmant at the end of ninth grade who had friends at the church that he could know and love, the kid would stay around. And if the kid didn't have any friends at church, his mom and dad could never hold him in the Christian community. What people want more than anything else from the Christian community is fellowship. It's love. And that's all that is. It's a sign we live in an impersonal, mobile society which doesn't have time for significant relationships. And so a congregation of the 1980s, which is really reaching out and reaching in, is a congregation which is doing everything to facilitate Christian community. And I'd like to talk about Christian community with three subgroups in that Christian community. One is in regard to reaching out to the single families. The greatest sociological change in American society has been the number of single families, moving from 4 million to 16 million in the last 20 years. That's the dominant social revolution in America. Where my kids go to school, in our school district, 85% of the children come from fractured families. Only 15% of the children in our school district have the original mother and fathers and brothers and sisters. It's basically a world of single, fractured families. And I'd just like to talk about that just a little bit. In our group, we have a group called Saturday. It's called Single and Traveling. And it's basically for single women, single men. There's other organizations in this, are in the community of Seattle, which really reaches out to them. We have lots of single men, but they choose not to be involved in the church in this way. But the single women in our church are all poor. They've really been broken. And we have a group called Saturday, so once a month we go places and we travel together. We've got a few vans at our church that we buy for old folks' homes. So during the week, the old folks' homes has them, and then the weekends we use them at a church for functions like this. And one Saturday, I remember we went over to the coast, and there were 25 women and myself, all single and myself, all working and myself. And we stopped at one of the rest stops, and the gals were really putting the moves and really having a good time. And there's two guys who were sitting in their big truck with their shotguns in the back window drinking their beer. And they were trying to figure out what I was doing with these 25 women. And when the gals saw that these two guys were kind of figuring out what was going on, the gals really started to play it up, you know, and get very affectionate with me and all this kind of stuff. And the guys couldn't figure out what in the Sam Hill was going on. Finally, the gals got back into the van, and we started to pull away, and I backed the car up, and I rolled down the window, and I said, "Eat your heart out, fellas." I says, "There's certain advantages to being a bishop in the Mormon church." Got in the car, boom, and away we went, you know. But I hear all kinds of stories in that group. I hear stories of women in our church who are seduced by their brother-in-law, and she can't tell her sister. She doesn't know how to tell her sister. Just the awful degree of sexual harassment that I hear among these women. It's abominable what they have to put up with. And the kind of conversations that I hear going on in those buses are just absolutely, just utterly fantastic, the kind of fellowship. And then recently in the life of our church, when one of the single women, her daughter was brutally murdered in Seattle, and it was all the single women from that group who rallied around her. What I'm saying is that unique. In the church of the 1980s, who was reaching out to unchurched people are going to be coming from a lot of fractured families. And if you're going to reach out to the unchurched people who come from fractured families, you better have a way in your congregation to reach those where they can be part of a community where they're known and loved. That's where you reach people. And we have all kinds of unchurched people coming into our church through the Saturday group. People who, and by unchurched means any person who's not been part of the church for 5 or more years. Unchurched people are very devout people, tend to be. People who believe in Jesus Christ, are ruled by Jesus Christ, who believe in Christ but choose not to belong to the church. They may have been burned immeasurably by the church. In fact, if you sit and talk to them long time enough, you will find out that most of them have been burned by the church and don't want to have anything to do with the church. And therefore, a lot of your beginning conversations have to do with the spirit of gentleness and asking their forgiveness for the way that the church has alienated them. I can't begin to tell you the number of conversations that anybody who works with unchurched people with any degree has. So when you talk about Christian community, to the unchurched, you talk about fractured families, you talk about single people, you talk to divorce. Another very dominant category in America, a second major social revolution in America, when you're talking about unchurched, is young adults, ages 20 to 30. Who's 20 to 30 in this group right here, okay? You people are 20 to 30. Right now there are 40 million of you in America. There's twice as many of you than any other age group in America. There's twice as many of you than there are of me, who am aged 41. That this is the baby boom are those from 20 to 30. And these young, and there's just a massive amount of people. So pastors can't quite figure out what's going on in the church. Right now they have almost no 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th, and 10th graders. And they got a swarm of 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. And they can't figure out what they're doing to make this change. They're not doing a thing. All that's going on is that there's the largest group in our society right now is from 20 to 30 that are having babies, and the church of the 1990s will be the church which figures out to reach to the young adults, both single and married. The church of the 1980s, and the best chapter that you can read on this is Lyle Schaller's book, Creative Church Administration, Chapter 7, has the most provocative chapter for a congregation who wants to reach out to people, churched and unchurched, young adults from 20 to 30. Why is all our advertising geared that direction? That's where the bucks are. That's where the people are. That's where our whole culture is oriented in that direction right now. Third major group that the church of the 1990s ministers to is those who are 55 and older. Again, there's been a demographic change in American society. That group also is twice as large as it used to be 20 years ago. 55 and older, especially the 55 to 75 group. You have all kinds of people who are finishing their careers at age 55. Now they have a second career. And so the church of the next generation is finding ways to meet the needs of this group. So I'm saying the church has basically, in and of itself, it has a mission to itself. That is word. We are nourished by the words of Christ, the sacrament, and the Christian community. Then the church also has a mission outward into the world. And that also has three cylinders on it. One is that we are to be the love of Christ in the world. Now, we all know that. No matter what we do and where we go, we are to be the love of Christ. We are to be the leaven in the lump. We are to permeate society and make it a better place in which to live. We all know that, okay? So I'm not going to talk about that. But now the mission of the local congregation also includes point 2 and 3 up here. One is social justice, and the third one is evangelism. Now, a congregation which is really healthy would put points number 2 and 3, that is social justice and evangelism, under point 1, love of Christ. But in most Lutheran congregations, there's almost no emphasis whatsoever on social justice nor evangelism. Basically, we function on 2/3 of the cylinders. We do 1, 2, and 3, the word, the sacraments, and Christian community. We do the love of Christ. But basically, in the Lutheran church, we ignore social justice and evangelism. Let me give you an example of that. Let's talk about social justice. Recently, I'm doing some research on preaching right now, and it's interesting, I read the 8 volumes of a set of books called the Augsburg Sermons. It's a book of sermons written for Lutheran pastors. Do you know that in 8 books, at about 300 pages, that's 2,400 pages, there are almost no references to anything that has anything to do with political injustice? Almost none. Lutheran pastors never talk about those kinds of things. Basically, in the Lutheran church, if you've read the surveys, basically we're a quietistic church. I think the great example of that is what happened in Germany during World War II, and what happened to the Nazis and the Jews. What was the reaction of the Lutheran church? Silence. That's what the Lutheran church does when it comes to social injustices. We are silent. Well, that's totally unbiblical. It's unchristian. That's contrary to the intention of Christ. And the whole thrust of the local congregation is also to be involved in issues of social justice. Wherever we got the notion that the church is not to be involved in injustice. I mean, I was thinking of that movie last night. I was thinking of that movie that that we saw about South Africa, and you see that woman who's feeding a child. She's feeding a child, and her baby died of malnutrition. And you say, the church should not... Is that a political question? That's a moral question, and also a political question. Therefore, churches who are involved in issues of social justice obviously are involved in multitudes of ways. They have all kinds of educational programs. They're involved in world hunger. They're involved in refugee work. They're working with prisons. The whole thrust of the church is not just to be a middle-class club talking together, navel-gazing with each other about Jesus. I mean, that is not the church at all. So a church, and the way you define, the way a pastor defines the mission of the church, the way will be the pastor leads that congregation. And if you talk to a pastor who says, aha, the church is to be involved in word and sacrament, and says no more than that, that will probably be the emphasis, point number one and two, to the neglect of some other dominant missions in the church. So the church needs to be involved in issues of social justice. Personally, I find one of the best ways to do that, by the way, well, there are just so many ways. You use your own imaginations. But one way to do that is, I found in many congregations, is that they have a Christian political reading group where they meet once a month to read books. And during the course of the year, they may work through like three or four books in South Africa. And the next 3 or 4 months, they will work through three or four books on El Salvador or something like that. And you know what that does? It just transforms the preaching of the life of the pastor if he's involved in those discussion groups. Utterly fantastic. The pastors that I've known who are alert to that are reading this kind of emphasis. Well, then the third great mission of the church is that of evangelism. And evangelism is making disciples. It's converting people to Jesus Christ so that more people will live under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. That is point three, evangelism. But I want you to see evangelism in the larger concept of the whole mission of the church. Very important. Because if somehow you just focused on this and ignored the others, we would miss the great mission of the Jesus Christ in the world. And so the metaphor is basically we have a six-cylinder car, and lots of churches limp along in four cylinders or three cylinders, and the whole, if you got a car with six cylinders, you might as well have all six functioning. Okay, now I'd like to talk basically about evangelism and our problem in our Lutheran heritage.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
How have you left out one, for instance, you say they've not done anything about social justice. Why are the pulpits of the land silent about our moral conditions in America? Living together without marriage, just like the old Roman Empire.
Yeah. I would not disagree with you at all. For me, that's point one. That's preaching the word. That's preaching. What you're talking about is preaching the word. And we certainly need to be doing that.
You don't hear it from anybody. You don't hear it from Billy Graham or any of the big preachers. You don't hear it from any pulpit.
I don't hear a lot of preachers preach, so I can't tell you what other preachers say. I just don't know. I know what I say, but I don't know what other preachers say. Pardon? Well, I think that in terms of the private moral life, at least when I went to the seminary, that was a very dominant theme. And I assume most of my friends are like myself, and there really is a great concern about sexual relationships which occur outside of the marriage covenant. That the whole nature of a covenant between a man and a woman was to be for eternity, was to be for this life, to be faithful to each other. Those kinds of things are really part of our, of our preaching. I know it's certainly part of mine, but I cannot speak for other pastors. Would like to move on, not trying to ignore your question, but knowing that we could get off on that whole theme to be a full evening's discussion. Would like to talk about why the Lutheran Church is so quietistic about talking to others about Jesus Christ. We in the Lutheran Church have a great aversion. As you may know, studies say that 90% of Lutherans rarely or never, it's 50% are never and 40% rarely, speak to others about Jesus Christ. So basically you have 90% of the Lutherans in America almost never talking to anybody about Jesus Christ, which accounts for the fact that Lutherans on the average gain 4 baptisms per congregation a year, and basically those are adult baptisms, and those are basically people who are marrying into the Lutheran faith. I talked to a gal tonight at the dinner table, her name is Rosemary, who had taken this course a while ago, and she said, you know, I was raised as a Nazarene, and there when we as a Nazarene, we were trained to talk to people about Jesus Christ, and then I became a Lutheran and I quickly forgot. She said it just wasn't emphasized again until very recently in the life of her congregation. I would like to explain how that happened very briefly in the Lutheran Church. As you know, in the time of the Reformation, Luther, it was thought at that time that either the provinces in Germany were either Catholic provinces or Lutheran provinces. And all the Lutherans moved into one province and all the Catholics moved into the other province. That's just the way it was. It was a matter of life and death, you know. And so you chose your province, where you are. Your religion was the religion of the prince, okay? That's just the way it was. And then a short time during the Reformation, Luther also appointed the princes to be bishops, and you had the beginning of the state church, which now exists in Germany and, you know, to our part of the world, to that northern Europe until this day. And so basically everybody in your geographic region became Christian. They were all baptized, they were all confirmed, they were all married, they were all buried in the church. And so everybody was, you know, thought, well, of course, everybody's Christian. Well, that was the European milieu from which our church grew up. It is called the Corpus Christianum, where the body of Christ is the nation. Well, then all these people from Germany and Norway and Sweden and Denmark moved over to the United States, and we had little more Norway, little Sweden, little Germany, you know, and North Dakota was basically the Lutheran Church at Prayer, and you had Minnesota and Iowa, just so heavily national churches. And again, there was no need to reach out to the unchurched, no need. And so the Lutheran Church was basically a nurturing church. So now we move into this generation, and that just continued for, you know, for centuries, and then we move into this generation, and almost all the pastors tend to come, in the Lutheran Church, tend to come from the Midwest. There's kind of small town boys from the Midwest. Now that's not all, but the highest percentage. They're just like me. Small town, little town in Minnesota, everybody's Lutheran or Christian. You just assume you do that. I go to this seminary in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it's 75% of the are in Minneapolis, our church. It's 80% around Wartburg, you know? And so if everybody's around you is churched, why would you even bother to have a course in evangelism? So I never had one at the seminary. That was just totally unimportant because our whole environment, there was no need for it. But then we come out here to the West Coast, and it's a different ball game out here. And all of a sudden, I have to start to learn, and other pastors have to learn skills that we never learned at the seminary. And that's why almost all the really creative work that's been done in evangelism, regardless of denomination, almost all comes from the West Coast. It's kind of interesting. Almost all are from unchurched areas of the country. Because out of necessity, people have had to devise training programs for them. But basically, not to fault our Lutheran church, but ours has basically been a nurturing church where we had a state church background. It's kind of a footnote. I was reading a book yesterday. It's called The Trouble of the Church by Helmut Thielicke. And he was talking about in Germany right now, only 5% of the people go to church. In fact, you know what he was saying? The Lutheran church is so dead in Germany, we maybe should get rid of it and all go back to being Catholics. That's kind of interesting. You know, because the Lutheran church in Germany was that dead, he had about given up hope on it. And from my point of view, and from many other people's, a lot of this is a result of the national church, the state church. It's just an incredible, incredible, devastating situation there. Okay, so what we need basically, what this course tries to do is to create three changes. One in the pastor, and in the congregation, and the evangelism committee. We'll skip point three. But we're going to talk about the pastor, okay? Let's just talk about myself. I found out for myself as I started to try to do something like this is that I was at the very heart of the problem. I didn't know beans from apples about evangelism. I never had any training. And so I used to do the dumbest things in our congregation. I'd take our church council and have them going out, calling out apartments, you know, just utterly stupid things. I just didn't know anything about it. And I was never educated in it. I was trained to be a preacher. I was trained to be a theologian. I've been trained to be a counselor. I've been trained to be a teacher, but I was not trained to be an evangelist, nor somebody who equips somebody for evangelism. So I figured that one of the dominant problems throughout the Lutheran Church was pastors, just like me. We're a product of the environment. So then I started to think, how do you change a pastor? Boy, now pastors are kind of stubborn folks. And so it's really kind of hard to do. And the way I think a lot of pastors are changed is when they have to teach something. For example, the way I learned my Bible was having to teach the Bethel Bible series two or three times, just to teach it on Thursday nights, Friday nights, and Sunday nights. And by the third time through, I really started to comprehend the lesson. But the point is, when I was done in 3 years, I finally knew the Bible. I started to think, well, the way you attain change of pastor is try to bring a bunch of information together, have them teach the stuff, and maybe things would start to change for the pastor. And so all this material is I just read all the literature on evangelism, brought it together into one cover, organized the material so a pastor wouldn't have to read all that stuff, and tried to encourage a pastor to teach it three times the first year and two times and once every 2 years after that. And by the time a pastor takes this material and digests it, after he's taught it two or three, if you teach it, of course, just once, you never learn it. Okay, but if you teach it two or three times, you really know this stuff. And by then, you've made it your own. And so if and when a pastor teaches this stuff two or three times, then this obviously is his stuff. It's no longer mine. He's just doing it his own way. And it's designed in such a way that it doesn't encourage the pastor to do it my way, but to take the data and to do it their own way. And every pastor does it that way. I know those guys. They're like me. They'll all do it their own way. But the upshot of that is by the time that a pastor has done that, he starts to develop a whole new set of skills. That has happened to myself and so many of my pastor friends. They really have developed a new set of skills about leading the church in terms of evangelism. Second really problem area, which is even more difficult to train and change in the pastor, is to change the atmosphere of the congregation, or what I call congregational climate. Let me give you an example. Pastor moves to Minneapolis, Minnesota. He moves into a neighborhood, and he's not going to be a pastor in the church. He's going to work for church headquarters. He moves into this neighborhood, and so for the first time in his life, his adult life, he's not going to be a professional cleric. Moves in the neighborhood. All the people come over and said, "Hi, it's nice to meet you, Joan and Sally. Nice to have you here in the neighborhood. The good stores are right down here, and the doctors are here, and the dentists are here, and this is where you go shopping." Nobody bothered to tell him about anything about the church. You know, everybody talked about everything. They brought over pies, cakes. Nobody said a word to him about Christ, the church, and that kind of stuff. And so they went to the Yellow Pages to look up a church, and there were no maps or anything. He had no idea which church was closest to him. They finally picked one out, got over to that church, came into the parking lot just when the church was getting out, and all the parking cars are coming out this way, and they came into the parking lot the wrong direction. The parking lot usher shouted at them, tried to get their car to come in their other direction. They finally got the car coming in the right direction. They came in and stood in the narthex. Needless to say, nobody talked to them. They came in and they sat down. There was a new green hymn book, and this guy hadn't switched to the new green hymn book, and so he didn't know the liturgy yet. And so he was totally lost throughout the liturgy. They sang a couple of hymns, and they seemed to be in a different key than he used to sing them in. Sermon wasn't so bad, but again, after church, nobody addressed them. They got back into the car, and they drove away from the church, and they had a conversation they'd never had before. Do we want to go back to that church? Did that church really want us? And I think what happened, that church is so typical. So, in fact, studies that have been done on visitors in churches, how unaddressed they are. And so what most people, what most Lutherans do, when they think of Sunday morning, they come of thinking to be nourished by the word and by the sacraments and to see their friends. Basically, why I go to church on Sunday morning is to be nourished by the word and the sacraments, to see my friends, and I don't see Sunday morning as my occasion to speak to an unchurched or a stranger in the who's come to church that day. In fact, I really don't want to be bothered with him because I haven't seen Sam all week and I've really been looking forward to it. By contrast, you go to a Mormon church on Sunday morning and you are going to be enveloped because the very concept of Sunday morning is not only to feed oneself and by word and sacrament, but also Sunday morning is the occasion to reach out. It's the very nature of their mentality. And so one of the things that we need to begin to start changing and Lutheran churches on Sunday morning is the quality of friendliness, the quality of friendship that emanates on Sunday morning. It has to do with a pattern. I'll never forget a woman in our church. Her name was Veda, and she came occasionally, a good friend of ours and all those things. And her sister was going through a divorce and came to our church. And nobody talked to her for four times, and so she never bothered to come back. And Veda came up to me, and she says, "I now know what you've been talking about. I never bothered to talk to friends on Sunday morning, but now I know, because my sister got burned." But it's this whole thing called congregational climate. Well, how do you go about changing a congregation's climate? Very slowly. It took us 400 years to get into this mess, and it's not going to be just changed just like that. Very slowly. Basically, what this course is trying to do is trying to change the mood of the whole congregation. Okay? And so what this course is not trying to do is train 4 or 10 or 20 people to be a souped-up evangelism committee. It's trying to change the whole mood of the congregation. And so what we're trying to do in this thing is to get at least 50% of the congregation through the process. Okay? And let me just explain the process. It's not that complicated. Basically, have any of you been to Marriage Encounter? Marriage Encounter, what it does is you go to Marriage Encounter and you sit down and they give you a question, what is it that I like about my wife? And you write down for 5 minutes and she does the same thing, your husband, she writes 5 minutes and the two of them talk about it. Well, you come to this class and there's basically about 20 questions during the course of the 10 weeks. There's two a night, basically. And you write on the question, who are 5 people who influenced me towards Jesus Christ? And you write on that, and I write on that, and then we have a fruit basket upset and 2 people go and start talking to each other about people who influenced them about Jesus Christ. And what's funny is now at the church, for the first time since they've ever come to church, they're talking to somebody at church about Jesus Christ. That's kind of funny, isn't it? I mean, you can come to church for your whole life and never talk to anybody about Christ. I'd be interested in how many of you have had that experience, but it's a very uncomfortable place to go and talk to somebody about Christ at the church. You know, it's just really strange. But it is true. And so what we're trying to do is try to change that. And it's just utterly fascinating to hear people talking to each other about Jesus Christ at church. Now, you notice here there are no cans, there's no little speeches. Here's how to do it. Here's 14 little easy lessons to talk about Christ. Rather, what people are doing is using the native language of their own heart. Okay? Just kind of saying what they believe. Or what are my doubts? What is the thing that gets in the way of my believing in Jesus more than any other? This woman said, gee, my child died, was killed 7 years ago. It's so terribly hard for them. That was the hardest thing. And so then they talk about suffering and the nature of doubts. And all of a sudden they're talking about these critical questions of faith. And we talk to each other for maybe for 10 or 15 minutes. And then we're going to swap partners and I'm going to go and talk with you on the same question. And what happens is by the end of the process, the 10 weeks, lots of things have happened. But one of the most dynamic things that has happened is that you and I have become much closer as human beings. Because we've been talking one-on-one. Almost all the stuff in the course is one-on-one. In fact, 50% of the class is one-on-one dialogue with each other. And they're all non-threatening kinds of questions. Well, so that's, we're trying to get people to freed up to talk about Christ, whereby when a person starts talking about Jesus and the importance of Jesus in their life, and everybody's story is different. Everybody. Nobody does it alike. You ever seen that bowling ad, you know, when they show the people bowling and nobody does it alike? Well, nobody talks about Christ alike, that's for sure. You learn that very, very quickly. And you don't have any mold. Oh, you're supposed to do it? No. You do it the way that's natural for you. You share your own life story. Well, what's the homework? Well, the homework is kind of interesting. The homework is not to read a book. The homework is to go and find a person who is an unchurched person and ask them about their religious beliefs and convictions. Now, you got to be careful when you go there because, you know, you don't want to assume that they're a non-believer because this person may be very devout. In fact, the majority of people who are unchurched have been burned by the church in some way. So you've got to be careful. You don't come and say, well, I got Jesus and you don't. I come to save you. Oh, you're going to be in big trouble. But let's say that, and it was interesting at the dinner table tonight, there was a gal by the name of Rosemary, and we talked, and she said, well, is that your course? Were you involved in that course? And she said, let me tell you a story. And she had just moved down to Oregon, and she said, you know, I didn't have any unchurched friends. We were just new in the church. But one day when I took my kid to school, the coach said to my kid, I don't know how it was, that I have nothing to do with the church. And so I came up to him about a month later and I said, say, Sam, she says, I remember you saying that you never came to the church and I have an assignment where I have to talk to an unchurched person. Could I talk to you? And so they went, they sat in the library and she talked to this fellow, she didn't really know that way, about an hour, asking him why he chose not to be part of the church. You know, hey, you're a nice guy and all those kinds of things. Well, Sam, this coach, went back and talked to his family. He said, I had the strangest thing happen to me. This lady came up to me and asked me why I didn't belong to the church. 8 months later, this coach came and waved Rosemary down. She said, hey, I want to thank you. And she said, what for? She says, we've joined the Mennonite Church. And she says, well, terrific. Well, how did that? And he says, and I want to thank you because your conversation was the start of it all. And she says, you got to be kidding. And she says, no. And it was just kind of a funny situation. But that's what the homework is to go and find an unchurched person. An unchurched person is a person who's not been part of the church for 5 or more years. Okay, it's very important. We don't say the word unchristian. You say the word unchurched, because those may be very, very devout Christians. Okay, you always say the word unchurched. And the LCA has, of course, Word and Witness, and it's a good course. The only terrible thing through the whole course, they call unchurched people PCs. Potential Christians. And I thought, oh, jeez. In fact, that was one reason I couldn't use the course. It's just because, I'm sure they didn't mean it that way, but just the whole concept of potential Christians just was so obnoxious. especially when I had read all the statistics about the pain that the unchurched have suffered in the church. Well, so the homework is to go and find an unchurched person, and you ask them all kinds of questions. You know, you're really a devout person. You seem like a nice person. Why do you choose not to be part of the church? What happened to you? You know, what's your story? And don't worry, all people have a story about their relationship to Christ or the church or God. They all have a story. And so it's basically a listening witness working together with them. And it's interesting, all our people are just scared to do it. It's kind of like when I was a kid trying to kiss a girl for the first time, I was just scared. But after doing it, it got better, you know, with practice. And that's where the people, it's interesting with all the people in this course, the great resistance is the first time. But after the initial barrier is over, it's kind of interesting how receptive the unchurched are to conversation. So that's basically the course, is trying to work with the pastor to get him to start to read all this data. You learn so much. There's so much research that's been done on the unchurched during the last 10 years in American society. Massive amounts of research of why people have dropped out of the church. There's massive amounts of research done on, it's interesting why people join the church. People who have not been part of the church and why they come and join the church. Those people have been studied. All that research is in here. And so when I go on, I have all these unchurched people coming to church, I just load it with information as I start talking to them, knowing where they're coming from. It helps just immensely. Well, let's talk a little bit about the unchurched in America. Basically, there's three or four different ways to add it up. But basically, you have about 40 to 50% of American population who is unchurched. It depends on which poll you are using, or which method of research. But let's say that, including our very fringe people in the church, you have basically about 50% of Americans who are not part of the Christian community. Okay? Very important. Okay, the second thing, the first thing I'd like to say about this group of people is that, one, is when they become part of the church, they become your best evangelists. Okay? Let me explain this for a minute. Is that the longer you've been a Christian and the longer that you've been part of the church, the fewer unchurched friends you will have. Got it? Sociological fact. The longer you've been a Christian and the longer you've been part of one church, the fewer unchurched friends you're going to have. Okay? And that's why there's so many of the people in our church who have been part of our church for 20 years, I ask them to go and talk to the unchurched, they say, we don't know who to talk to. All our friends are part of the church. So, it becomes very wise is when you start to get a group of unchurched people, and those are the ones who I say, go and talk to your friends, because you know what? These unchurched people have scads of unchurched friends. See, they have the unchurched friends. And so when I, as a minister, start to use my brains a little bit, and I start now to work with these unchurched people, and every 2 years in the church who have now become part of the church, I put all kinds of energy into those people, because I know those are the folks who know the unchurched folks. And also, people who are just new to the church are often very enthusiastic. They're enthusiastic for Christ. They're enthusiastic for the church. They're just kind of an enthusiasm. Which a person belonging to the church for 24 years, it's hard to get excited about anything in the church. And they've been there before. And that's not a criticism. It's just they're in a different life space. And so these unchurched people are very important and they become part of the church. And our church, even after I taught this course for a while in our church just kind of stood. These guys, I thought, what in the Samuel is going on? And then gradually, a few of those unchurched people really started to go to work. And then it started to mushroom a little bit. And then the second thing I just want to emphasize about the unchurched, what I've already said before, is that they are people who are believers. So many of them are believers. And you better be careful if you suggest they aren't. It's something like 77% of them went to Sunday school. 75% of this 100 million want their children to go to Sunday school. 68% of them believe in the resurrection of Jesus. 64% believe in heaven and hell. 53% of them would join the church today if some church person would ask them. 53%, according to the studies. But 90% of the Lutherans are afraid to talk to them about Christ. And so we've got a Mexican standoff. We got 53% of the population who are really, really willing to be part of the Christian community. We got 90% of Lutherans who don't want to do anything about it. And that's kind of why we have this Mexican standoff. Okay, but they're very much believers. Only 13% of the unchurched in America say absolutely no, they would not be part of the Christian community. Only 13% do you get hostility from. Another item, I just really kind of covered that. Point three is that these people are very receptive very receptive to Christian conversation, to discussion of religious values. What they are not receptive to is self-righteousness. The number one thing that offends the unchurched more than any other that's mentioned in every research is the word hypocrite. And by hypocrite, they don't mean sinner. They don't mean sinner. By hypocrite, they mean that Christian, that church member thinks he's better than I am. That's what they mean by hypocrite. And I know that guy, and I know he's not. Okay? That's what they mean by hypocrite, is essentially self-righteousness. You know, when we think of a hypocrite, we think of somebody who's trying to, is pretending they are somebody who they are not. Okay? Basically, though, so what they are not receptive to is self-righteousness. Point four is an awful lot of these people have been burned. It's interesting that in the studies of people who have left the church, who were at one time very active in the life of the church, almost all of them have had very intense conflicts with the pastor. In fact, it's 45% of them have had intense conflicts with the pastor, 38% with another congregation member, and 32% with a fight in the family about sending the kid to confirmation. They've had conflicts. And how do you handle a conflict with some people? You just avoid them. You just don't go back and study. Whereas a study, and all of these people, by the way, had been on church councils. They had been really active in the life of the church, but now they had fallen far away. And by contrast, all of those who were presently on the church councils and active in church only had a 5.3% conflict with the pastor. You see? And so the absence of conflict mean that we're going to be together, and the presence of conflict meant the way they handled it was to leave. And the interesting thing, that the studies that had been done by, I forget the name of the research institute that did that, when I can't remember the name of that research institute, but they said that every one of the people that they went and visited who had been burned by the church, not one of them had been visited by anybody in the church, and that the vast majority of these people, when visited, broke down and cried in the conversation because the pain was so great. That's why when you deal with unchurched people, you often begin by asking for forgiveness for the way that they may have been stomped on by the church, inadvertently or directly. And so you find an awful lot of folks have been burned. Point five, the unchurched are highly mobile people. In fact, the number one reason why people leave the church, so statistics tell us, are mobility. 42% of the people, when asked why they are unchurched, said that they moved and never relocated with a new congregation. That's the number one problem. And if you come out here to a new congregation, if you come out to our church and try to become part of a friendship pattern, it's really hard. It's really hard. Churches are kind of closed groups. Especially the mentality is we go to church to see our friends and to receive the sacrament. And so if the whole climate of the church is basically inward, to serve ourselves rather than the unchurched community, it's really hard to break into a Christian congregation. As one woman said, an unchurched person who joined our church, she said, "I felt like I was a kid standing outside of the candy store window looking in, wish I could be a part of the fellowship, but couldn't find a way to get into the candy store," is the way she talked about it. Point six, the unchurched. 85% of the unchurched join the church through family, friends, and relatives. And it's interesting, they basically follow their friends and not their denominational brand loyalty. They don't join the church because it's Lutheran or Presbyterian or Methodist or Roman Catholic. They join it because that's where their friends go. Now you have to think of that right away. That is the way it used to be. That wasn't that way 30 years ago. But the way unchurched people join the church today is basically through friendship patterns and not through any brand loyalty whatsoever. And again, this has to do with age. It has to do, of course, if you're an older person, you follow a brand loyalty. You know, if you use Skippy peanut butter or you use cornflakes. If you're an older person, you always follow brand loyalty. If you're under 30, 35, you don't follow brand loyalty at all. And that's really true of how people join the church. 85% of the people who join the church are through family, friends, and relatives. So why should I bother in having our people go out and canvass the neighborhood? Basically, it's not the efficient way. If you have two or three Christian friends, it's through you. It's through your friendships. And so what I have to do as a pastor is to talk you into bringing your friends to the church and to talking to them about Jesus Christ. That's where all the action is, trying to persuade Lutherans to do that. And the last item I'll just mention tonight is that of family disintegration. When you work with the unchurched people, you have lots of family disintegration. My wife, for example, and she's happened to start teaching Sunday school a little bit this year, and she had our sixth grade class, and it was kind of interesting. There was 17 kids in the sixth grade, and on one Sunday there would be eight, and the next Sunday there would be another eight, and they were never the same. And she started to dawn on it. It had to do with visiting rights of the parents, is that the child would be visiting mom one weekend and dad the next weekend, grandparents next week. See, and she couldn't figure out what was going on. And there were different brothers and sisters all with the same name, and she just couldn't figure out what was going on. I said, well, Jan, those are all unchurched families who are becoming part of the Christian community, trying to put their lives back together again. And so those are some of the characteristics of unchurched people. I believe what I'll do is just stop here and open it up for questions that you may have. The church really needs to have lots of opportunities for single people. And also incorporate them into the larger community. But a divorced woman will normally tell you in the church, I'm the third wheel. I just don't feel right. No matter how hard we try, that is just a fundamental reality. So we try to do both. One is to create a group where these people can be together and do all kinds of things together, and always very inexpensively because they're always broke. We do economic subsidization of those families. By the way, that's really a good thing to do, by the way. There's an economic principle of the Book of Acts is that there be no poverty among us. That's the economic principle of our congregation. There'll be no poverty among us. And so somebody will come up and say, hey, I need $500 for my heating bill. And you just go to the congregation and say, we need $500 for the heating bill. You never say who it is. And, you know, we just do that all the time in the life of our church. But there's lots of economic subsidization of these people, because their eyes broke. Do lots of group process stuff. They just have a lot of fun being together. They now worship together. They sit with each other on notice in worship services. And we basically meet once a month and we do something that's pleasurable together for the day, for 4 hours, for 8 hours, 10 hours, something like that.
Are you doing anything with the couples?
That's very narrow. It's foolish. I mean, that's true, a family of one, you know.
I think that Father, mother, kid, family.
If you work with that, that's the nurturing model of the Lutheran Church. You know, it used to work, but that doesn't work anymore. Just to answer your question a little bit more, also, with a single woman in our church, we really talk that issue through, and everything in our church is advertised as adult, and we do everything possible. When you're talking about, come on, gals, there is a salmon bake this coming Sunday over at Anderson's, and let's make sure all the gals are there. They come, and then they're part of that community as well. Again, it's a different style whatsoever. I think the good thing about the evangelism explosion program is that it's doing something intentionally. Let me give you an example. One time I was up in Alaska doing a conference, and this part of the conference was on stewardship. And all the pastors in the group went around and shared what they were doing on stewardship. But the point is, everybody was intentionally trying to do something, and therefore some good things were happening. And it wasn't important that we had the same processes. And the Kennedy and that program and Evangelism Explosion, what they're trying to do is doing something concrete. And like every program, it depends on how the church handles it. Now, I talked to a woman the other day. They handle it just magnificently in their congregation. They aren't calling cold turkey on people and asking everybody their two questions. What they are doing simply, those who visit their congregation, if you come and, let's say, I'm a pastor at a church, you come and your family come and visit me, one of our lady the following week will call you and come out and have a sit-down, talk-to-talk, visit with you. And in that conversation, they will try to find out how it is between you and Christ. Okay? And so they use that program really effectively in the life of that parish. From my point of view, they tend to be rather wooden in their presentation. You know, they have a presentation that people develop and things like that. And I prefer not to do that in our methodology, basically to have you express it in your own way. But it's a good program. Never
knock
it.
I like PE because it forces you to memorize scripture.
Okay.
And I don't think that's emphasized enough in the church, memorization of scripture. How are you going to talk with someone if you don't know where it's found, if you don't know where you believe, if you don't believe that you must repent and you know, before you become a Christian?
She's been very helpful.
I am so frustrated with the church that there's not a responsibility of the person as a Christian within the community and within the church.
Absolutely would say amen to that. Last question? Any others? Yes?
You have problems when people do go out that they don't do all the talking and not the listening. It seems to me that most of us are much more willing to talk than to listen to somebody else's.
In this kind of emphasis, you're not going out and making calls about it. You're talking with somebody at Boeing over this machine. Mm-hmm. See, it's part of a friendship pattern. What this is trying to do is encourage dialogue with friends, people you already know. You're not going into somebody's house and making a house call. It's talking with people you already know about Christ, the church, and the mission of the church.